0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. Call up one going here, 51551 for your text, joe at rt.ie for your emails, 0871843709 for your WhatsApps. Alicia Murphy, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm a lot better than you by the sounds of it. Where and when did you last see your belongings?
So on the 2nd of June for the bank holiday on Friday, I decided to leave my accommodation and go back down for the week to Wexford to stay with my friend. And then I arrived back on the 30th. I ended up staying longer than I expected because I was unwell, but I went back up on the 13th to move my stuff out early as my lease ended on the 16th. And every single item I owned had been cleared out of my room.
And where was your room?
In one of the big student accommodation block companies in Grange Gorman in Dublin.
And how much had you been paying per month to live in this room? What was the rent?
So it's around 1,100 euro a month. So around 37 a night, I think.
And how long had you been living there?
Living there a couple of months since, I think, like end of March, April time. Just for the second semester, a place came up. So I was living in Diggs. So I decided, okay, this might be like safer. It's licensed. Like it's a proper kind of student accommodation. But
And who runs it?
So it's the company's called Hugo Residencies. They have multiple over Dublin in the Liberties and up around Phibsborough, Grange Gorman. And I think they have one in near the city centre called Blackhall Place.
So you packed up your stuff in the spring and you moved across town to this accommodation, Cairn House, run by Hugo. And
yeah,
tell us how it was. Did you have your own room?
Yeah, so I had my own room, bathroom, and then I just shared a kitchen with three other students. It was fine. Like, it was nice. The people who worked there, they were very young. Like, they would have, I think they were kind of in college. So, if you had any issues, you'd kind of have to not go to reception. You'd have to go to, like, a higher email, like a higher management.
But any issues until then in Ardkern House? You know,
not particularly. There'd be like noise issues and stuff, like expected stuff in student accommodations, but nothing like of any like alarm anyway. Other than the day I left to go to Wexford on the 2nd, loads of people's tenancies ended, and I had a cleaner walk into my room that day, and I was like, oh no, like I'm not moving out. And she was like, oh, sorry. She was actually in my room when I came back from the kitchen. She was already in. She'd already let herself in.
Right. So you had paid up until when?
The 16th, this Friday. I was doing them a favour, moving my stuff out like on Tuesday, like 3 days early.
Well, you thought you were going to move your stuff out. So you'd gone down to Wexford on the 2nd. You came back up on Tuesday. What happened? Yeah.
So I had forgotten my fob. It's like electronic fobs. They were fine. They were like, that's okay. We have a master key for every room. So one of the ladies in reception was like, I can just bring you in. Like, you're not living here anymore. I said, I'll drop the fob in a couple of days before the 16th. If you can just let me in, I can just clear my stuff out today. I need to get it. It's the only day I have a lift up as well. And she was like, no problem, whatever. So she, completely unaware, she let me into my apartment, my block door, then my apartment door, and then to my apartment, like my room door. And when I walked in, the room had been like cleaned, and the bed, it was just a mattress, and everything was empty and cleaned. And I just like started sobbing.
Gone. Everything, not a stitch, nothing, no trace that you'd ever been there left.
No, my MacBook, my like everything was gone.
And when you say everything, you've mentioned a MacBook. How much is a MacBook?
So it was a 2021 MacBook. I think I paid like close to a grand to it at the time, over a grand, I think. I'm not sure. I got it for college. Like, it had lots of stuff on it.
And not just stuff that was, you know, on You had stuff saved to the hard drive because it was...
Yeah, I had stuff saved to my... Like, I didn't really expect anything. I'm quite good with my things. Like, I wouldn't expect anything like that to happen.
Right, so a MacBook, that's pretty much irreplaceable given that you had some stuff on the hard drive. So you're worried about that. Anything like, you know, documentation, bank cards, licenses, anything like that?
Yeah, so basically my mum lives in the UK. We used to live here when me and my sister got old enough. She moved back to the UK. So I basically have... every single thing I own, and that's my home, like that room for the like that for the last couple of months. Like I had every single thing I owned. I had my bank cards. I have no form of ID. My age card, my passport was in the room.
Your passport gone as well.
My passport. I can't even go and see my mum. Even on the boat, like I still need photo ID. My student ID was in the room. Documents were in the room. Medication was in the room. Clothing,
any
bags,
valuables?
Jewelry. Loads.
Okay, God.
Jewelry, right. Like expensive jewelry, expensive bags, shoes, every pair of shoes I own, except for flip flops that I came down to Wexford in.
So you were there, standing there in your flip flops, hoping to pick up a few, you know, for the change in the weather. The flip flops are all right today, but not forever in this country.
Yeah, not forever, I know. Like I had Doc Martens, North Face coats, like I had all my winter clothes in the room as well, in suitcases.
Right, your favorite clothes.
Literally thousands of, and I would be like super into clothes and like fashion, and I built up so myself, like paid for all my own stuff for so long, and I've built up such a like my identity basically, and it's just gone. It's just been totally discarded, like it was nothing.
And when you know, when you say there was jewelry missing, there some of it valuable, sentimental value, any of it?
A lot of valuable jewelry, that gifts and stuff, like inherited jewelry. Stuff I'll never, it's like in infinite value. Like I'll never be able to get it back. I had pearls my dad had got me in Vietnam. Like stuff I'll just never be able to replace.
And was it when you left your room on the 2nd of June, you know, how was it set up? Was your stuff just laid out as if you expected to come back and pick it up from there? Or had you started packing up already?
I'd started packing up, but a lot, like 90% of my stuff was loose. Like I had my suitcases, but they were already full with my winter clothes. So I'd just taken a couple of suitcases down. And like that was kind of the main thing. A couple of things were in like bags and stuff, but I had my toothbrush on the sink. I had my shower gel and my razor in the shower. Like I had my MacBook obviously there, my ID, my jewelry box was there, like out, visible.
Right, so for anyone coming into the room, either, you know, to clean it or to give it a look over, it was clear that somebody at least thought they were still living there.
Yeah, like, I'm so baffled as to how someone, even if they did make a mistake and think someone wasn't living there, how did they not flag it? Like, how is that not a red flag? The room is full of things, like... I had photographs and everything like on the wall and stuff. Like, I just don't get it.
And when you came up, did you have to use the fob to open the door?
Yeah, so it was a master fob. She opened it for me.
And the door swings open and you see the bare room.
Yeah, so the doors in there, like they're electronic, like they just close behind you. And then you need your fob to get back in. But yeah, I literally saw the bare room and I just started sobbing. My stepmom basically came up with me and she was like, don't worry, like, calm down. And they were like, oh, well, she didn't really know what to say. Like, I felt bad for her. She would just been like an employee. She was like, I'm sure we'll find it. It's in storage, I'd say. Like,
this is your stepmom was saying this. She had given you the lift up and she was, you know, she was there to take your stuff away.
Yeah. And I came back down with an empty car, basically. But they said that, like, the lady who'd let us into the room, she kind of saw my reaction and saw I started crying. She was like, come back into reception and you can wait and we'll locate the things. Like, don't worry about it. But I kind of knew at that point, like, I was like, they're not going to be paying for storage for something. Like, and why wouldn't they have contacted me? So we went back out to reception and we sat there for 45 minutes. During those 45 minutes, I was hysterical. I called my mum, like, family and stuff. And while I was out there in the courtyards, I noticed these two huge green, full to the brim, industrial size skips.
All right. So you already suspected the stuff would be ditched. You had your suspicions that it wouldn't be in storage, even though
suitcases and everything.
Right. Were you hopeful, though? I mean, your stepmother, you said, was there saying, look, I'm sure it's in storage. She was appalled. She obviously thought nobody would throw all of this stuff out, did she?
Yeah, she was totally like, there's no way. There's no way.
There's no way someone would throw out
a MacBook, like, or whatever. They just, that's not real. Like, don't worry about it. And then after 45 minutes, she had an appointment in Dublin. She drove me up. So I was like, go. It's fine. Like, I'll try deal with this. Like, you can meet me after your appointment. So I was there for 45 minutes with my friend sitting there, and they eventually were like, after a while, they were like, we can't locate your stuff. But if you, they were really nonchalant about it.
They were in the reception. Were they making phone calls as you were there? Could you hear what they were saying?
They all went into the back. I heard like kind of mumbling in the back and stuff for a while, but no, they're like, I couldn't actually see what they were doing.
Was anyone coming out and checking on you, or even to say, yeah, she's still here, or, you know, see how you were doing?
Well, I got to the point where I was like, I'm not sitting here all day. I'm starving. I'm like bawling, crying. I don't want to be sat here waiting. Can you just give me an update? And she goes, we actually can't locate your things. But if you just give us a list of the things that were in the room, then we can like see what we can do and stuff. And I literally got a bit angry at this point. I was like, it's everything I own. I was like, it's my passport, my MacBook. I can't go and see my mum like I planned to this week. I was like, I'm literally left with nothing. And then I was like, I'll leave my number if you have. And I was like, I'm not making a list now off the top of my head in case they like can come back on it and be like, well, you only said this and this. Like every few minutes I remember more stuff I had in the room or more clothes or, you know, like it's everything I owned.
And how long sort of have you been self-sufficient? You mentioned, you know, your mum moved back to the UK and you've basically been self-sufficient, carrying your own stuff in the bags around with you. I mean, how long had you been, you know, operating off your own steam and carrying your own belongings around?
So September, I moved to my room in Drumcondra and I lived there, and that was like fine. It was good. And over that time, I was working loads and I was paid my own rent. And I built up, like, even before that, I was sort of living at home, sort of in my mum's, sort of like in Wexford. I stay with friends a lot and stuff. I have great friends, but like I more or less took the decision when I was like in September, okay, I need to like have somewhere permanent. So I moved.
So you have everything. It's winter clothes, as you said. Yeah. It's summer clothes. Yeah, it's everything. Jewelry. It's documents.
It's like home. It's the lot. Well, plates, pots, pans. Like stuff that, yeah, like the family have given me, like pots, pans, plates, like every single thing I could have possibly have owned or been given or spent money on is just totally gone.
Right. And anyone or everyone who's lived in rented accommodation knows the drill that, you know, that's you have everything with you so you can start up when you have to move accommodation. Now, we have been in touch with Hugo. We are waiting for a response from them. But have you heard anything from them since?
So I have I've obviously had legal advice and stuff like that. And they've emailed, I'm CC'd in all the emails. They've not directly offered any yet, as of now, any form of like reimbursement or compensation or anything. All they keep saying is we're investigating.
They
also said that some of their staff were instructed to go through the skips yesterday and they couldn't identify any of my four not inclusive to everything I've lost. Obviously there was four suitcases that would be like big and identifiable. One was like big red one and stuff, and apparently they've been through these like industrial 6-foot skips full.
Yeah, go back to them, because you're sitting back on Tuesday. Yeah. You're sitting in reception. You know, you've had your suspicions that your stuff is gone, and you look out the doors and you see these massive, as you described them, industrial green skips. I mean, we attempted to hop in.
I did go out and I looked. I wouldn't have been able to hop in. They're literally like, I would have had to have had a ladder or like some. They're that big. Like they're the biggest ones you can get, literally. So I looked as best as I could on the top. I couldn't see any of my stuff. If my room was cleared out, like the day I left on the second or the day after, when a lot of people's tenancies were over, I'm sure my stuff has already been got rid of already nearly 2 weeks ago, or it's at the very bottom of the skip. and we had thunderstorms and stuff on Monday evening after like the weekend. So I'm sure all of it was like ruined anyway.
And your MacBook, you know, in the normal course of events, I don't know if you've ever lost it before, but is there the capacity there to do, you know, is it linked to an iPhone with a kind of a Find My Device type option or app on it?
Yes. So I have, obviously the first thing I did was try, but I'm sure my MacBook, if it's been sitting there for 2 weeks, I'm sure it's dead. The battery on, you probably know, on Apple stuff wouldn't be like super great because they're such like high-tech computers. Like you, most of the time you do have to have them plugged in, and also it wouldn't be connected to any Wi-Fi and it would be closed on standby.
Right, and its last known location is the same location you had last seen, yeah, which was your room.
Yeah, it's been totally blank since like the 1st of June or something.
And did they tell you what the protocol was? I mean, look, people leave clothes in their room. Sometimes people leave in a hurry. You know, they sweat down their belongings. They leave clothes they don't want in rented accommodation and they head for the airport and they let people, you know, dump the clothes. But in terms of valuables, yeah, jewellery, these kind of things, I mean, did Hugo tell you what their protocol is with dealing with valuables?
Yeah, so
I mean, are the staff who clear them out allowed to hang on to them? Are they instructed to dump them? Do they keep them in storage? Do they donate them to charity? Do they give them to a charity shop?
It says in, so the day of the 2nd, loads of people were moving out that day. And I think that possibly could have been the reason for why my mistake was why it happened. But they basically say anything left in the rooms will be dumped.
Just dumped.
Yeah. So like, and our friend of a friend, she again with not the same company, but another student accommodation, same thing happened to her. A lot of her stuff had been just cleared. Thank God she took a lot of it home with her because she'd been gone for a month or two. But again, they just dumped it.
And what happened in her case? She was still, had paid up and it was dumped before she had she was supposed to move out, was it?
Yeah. Again, she'd still paid the like rent and
she made
did
she get any compensation from them?
So she got reimbursed for what the clothes were worth. It wasn't that much. I think it was just kind of clothes and a few shoes and stuff, but she got reimbursed as long as she didn't go to the police.
As long as she didn't go to the police. Right.
The guards, like, I went to the guards and I made my statement and stuff already, regardless of any other, like, I don't know, option they could have given me, just out of like panic anyway.
Yeah, I feel like had you come back to your room and the door was broken and you'd been robbed, I suppose you could rationalise that as bad luck. But does it make it worse that this was avoidable?
Yeah, like I'm just so, well, I'm like heartbroken, obviously, because it's every single thing I own. But I'm just baffled as to how they, first of all, didn't check like what rooms need to be cleared, what rooms are vacant, because people stay there, they extend their leases through the whole summer till the 25th of August, I think. So like, I don't know how they just, it's pure negligence, I think, of just them not double checking.
I suppose we don't know what happened. We won't prejudge any legal outcome on it. But anyway, we have a statement for them. It says, we're aware of an incident at Ardkern House. We're investigating this matter as a priority. We are liaising with the resident, presumably that's you, to offer support while we establish what's happened. What form is that support being offered in, Leisha?
Like, I've not been offered, like, any even monetary funds to even get me, like, I don't even have a pair of underwear to my name. Like, nothing basic stuff I don't have. Like, literally just human basic stuff. They've not offered me any type. And I saw a case in the UK and she said that they immediately offered her, the manager immediately offered to go out and get her like hair dryer, like pajamas, clothes, like
the basics,
whatever basics, like basics, just till they can kind of solve it, just as a goodwill gesture. But no, I've not like heard anything directly. And first of all, when it first happened, they were like messaging me on WhatsApp in regard to it.
Right. So anyway, and have you drawn up the full list at this stage and sent it on to them of all the stuff you're missing?
No. So I'm alongside, like, obviously with legal advice, I have done it to like a certain extent, but I literally keep seeing, I'll see a picture of myself wearing something and I'll be like, oh my God, that was in the room. That's gone.
Okay. So still very much a work in progress.
Yeah, it really is. Like the sheer volume of stuff I had in the room is just like unbelievable that they've got rid of. Like, I don't, or whatever they've done with it, I don't know.
Okay. Okay. Well, look, Leisha, the very best of luck with getting it back. I hope it is found somewhere, and maybe the sheer size of the pile of suitcases that may be on top of your stuff, if indeed it was in the skip, might have saved them from any of the effects of the weather. But as I say, we wish you well. We're back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Call a moment going here, 51551 for your texts, 087 184 3709 for your WhatsApps, or you can get us by email, joe@rte.ie. Niall Brennan, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colm, how are you?
Good. How long has Loughran's Pub been in your family?
Well, the date above the door is 1888, but there was recently an article in the Chronicle about who owned what land. We were leasing this land from Lord Rowe before that, so we're here since the founding in Avon, I'd say.
Right, so a historic pub. For anyone who doesn't know Loughran's Pub, what does it look like?
It's on the main street, so it's sort of a narrow building. It's long and slim, like a lot of pubs. We have a huge beer garden, but it's primarily a racing pub in the daytime. We'd have music then at the weekends. Bit of everything, like a normal country pub, you know. You try and appeal to all.
And down one side of it runs a lane.
Yes, well, the town has several laneways. We've a laneway of our own that leads into down into our beer garden. That one is thoroughly policed, as you can imagine.
By yourselves. And then there's another nearby lane, and this is where the problems begin, is it?
Yes. I mean, there's so much violence and assaults and different things going on around the town. But a lot of it stems from around the main square, these multiple alleyways. There are youths hanging around late at night, particularly at the weekends, underage, drinking cans, dealing drugs, taking drugs, but also waiting for, let's say, a small fight to happen between friends after the nightclub. They'll come running in and bust you. They're ruthless.
So they're waiting for something to start, and then they pile in to make it a bigger fight than it was to begin with, is it?
Yeah. That's kind of a sport for them, it seems. But they're also out there preying on people too. You know, if they find someone drunk enough on their own enough, they will mug them. I've had customers come in and say they were mugged the night before, and we know the characters involved. Random arguments and things that end up with like a stone being thrown, glasses being smashed in the streets, just random acts of violence and thuggery.
Right, and how regularly, how many nights a week would you say this is going on?
I mean, people will tell you now that in the last few months and years, Navan has lost the sense of security that it had. So, I mean, generally all around the place, you're seeing there's no Garda presence, and there seems to be an increase in sort of, you know, recognisable thugs, you know, guys in tracksuits with their hands down their pants and carrying cans around in the middle of the day and roaring and screaming at each other. And
What age of fellas are you talking about?
I mean, there's one particular crew that I obviously encounter a lot because they hang around out front of us, and these would be from 12, 13, all the way up to 19, 20. But, I mean, there's different characters.
And are the 12 and 13-year-olds drinking cans and engaging in the drug-taking and dealing, indeed?
Yeah, that appears to be what... I mean, I can't necessarily say anyone that is doing anything, but you know what I mean? There's definitely transactions going on, and
right.
The older lads get arrested or so on, or get chased by the guards and searched, but the kids don't.
And you said there you're concerned about the Garda presence of the town. In fact, you've written to the Minister for Justice about it, but your own concerns about the level of Gardaí patrolling in the streets, you know, you say they chase them away, so there's not no Gardaí on the streets. There is some level of patrolling, but not enough in your view.
Yes, I mean, we as a group of publicans have had a meeting with the Gardaí, and the retailers have had a meeting with them the week before, and they'll tell you themselves, the division here is one of the most undermanned in the whole country, and they simply don't have the resources to deploy people on the beat when they need to respond to calls, and there are a lot of calls. You know, Navan it covers a huge catchment area of hinterlands that needs support from this Garda station as well.
Right. How long have you been working in the pub, Niall?
I mean, all my life I've been helping out. My grandfather ran the pub when I was a kid and taught me how to pull pints when I was about 11. But I've been managing it now for the last 2 years.
And would you say that, you know, the deterioration has started during that time, or does it predate that, the antisocial behaviour? When do you think it started, or and why?
Well, my neighbour, who would be managing a pub longer than me, would say that the last 5 years it's been deteriorating. But certainly post-COVID. I think that COVID, you know, there was a lot of kids running around the town and stuff and getting away with things. And I don't know, cocaine has become an enormous problem. There's so much drugs in the town. The Cardi will tell you themselves, there's an enormous amount of drugs in the town. And that, plus some sort of social malaise where people have people don't call the Gardaí, they don't have faith in the institutions, they don't think that justice will be done. So that, right.
So they're just kind of resigned themselves to a kind of a normal level of antisocial behaviour. They've come to not like it, but almost accept it or resign themselves to it.
Yeah, I think so.
And what about your own customers? You mentioned that some of your own customers had been affected by, you know, talking about coming in the next day and saying they'd been mugged the night before. So, like, can you give us examples of what has happened to your own customers?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I had a pensioner mugged a couple of weeks ago when he came out from a bar late at night. You know, one person tried to engage him and the other person slipped their hands in his pocket and ran away. I've had another customer walking home late at night. There's a group of, I don't know, three young people, like they could be adults, were under a bridge waiting for someone to come along, and they jumped them from behind, pushed them on the ground, held them down, took his stuff out of his pockets. There's so much, like almost every day someone will come in, well, at least once a week someone will come in and say there's been something dreadful here or there. There's a particular set of apartment blocks where there are junkies and vagrants in a couple of the apartments, and they smash windows and kick down doors, and that happens on the regular. So you just hear of random acts all the time.
Right. Okay. Well, as you say, there is antisocial behaviour, but we won't pin it to any one particular group, including, as you say, the addicts. You mentioned your own pub has been targeted, though, as well, the historic facade on it.
Yes, we had our windows smashed in broad daylight two Sundays ago.
What time of the day?
12:20, 12:20 p.m. They stopped traffic. I mean, there was a line of cars behind them all looking at this. Other businesses were open. Business owners came out and looked and saw. I mean, it all happened very quickly. They jumped out of a car and smashed my windows and drove off. And it's as ridiculous as it is to say it, it is probably simply because I refused to serve them, maybe. I don't even know.
So
later on that night.
Lunchtime on a Sunday, broad daylight, as you say, people hop out of the car and people... So it wasn't just a quick stone through the window. If people were attracted to it, they must have been there at the window for a while trying to break it, were they?
Well, about a minute. But, you know, a minute with a tire iron is quite a long time.
And were you in the pub at the time?
No, I had actually just left the premises about 5 or 10 minutes earlier. And I shudder to think what would have happened if I'd been on the street instead of just gone away from the pub. But I did have staff inside getting ready to open. We were 10 minutes away from opening at that time.
And what was their reaction?
Well, I mean, apart from the first percussive bang, which they attributed to the roadworks that are going on outside, they didn't really hear much. It was only then when the shopkeepers on the street called us to say, holy moly, we've just seen something unbelievable happened, they were even alerted to it.
And what the other shop owner saw was one fella going out the window with a tire iron.
Yeah. Then jumping back in the car and tearing off. Now, I should say for context out of this, like the people who are involved in that were arrested later on for multiple other things. Like it's
right.
I would say the bottom line
but did they break
not
the
so
window?
Much us, but the drugs and the sense that they are above the law and the confidence they have that there aren't going to be Gardaí walking around the corner. I mean, this just simply wouldn't happen if they felt that two guards could walk around the corner at any moment.
All right. And just going back to the damage in the pub itself. So, I mean, a tire iron meets the historic front of Loughran's pub. What's the scale of the damage?
Well, thankfully, our glass is installed by Gibney's Glass, and it is absolutely impenetrable. Two lads with weapons couldn't get through that window. It's right. still, apart from them putting a couple of holes in it, it's still entirely intact. Like, you couldn't push your way through it or anything. But the glass itself is quite expensive security glass. But the main concern isn't the glass. It's the 130-year-old odd wooden frames that potentially the bed of which we can't really see if it's rotted or will it bear the weight of another massive slab of glass being installed again.
Right.
In which case, then the facade might have to be, I don't know what the procedure would be to make sure that the timber that we use to replace is correct and all that.
Right. Why is there kind of a preservation order because of the historic nature of the front of your pub?
Yeah, the entire facade of Trimgate Street are historically protected.
Right. So,
most of the facades on the street.
And is there much damage to the frame? Like, at least the frame that's in vision above the brick?
No, the frame itself. No, they went for the glass. The frame itself is actually, it seems intact. That we're semi-confident we'll just be able to put the glass in. It all just depends on the bed directly under, because it's quite thick glass, you know, so it's sitting on a wide piece of wood that is quite old. So if the wood there, I don't really quite understand it. Just the glassmaker told me that.
Well, you're a publican, not a glazier. Would you stick on it?
Yeah.
Would you stick on at the job? They say, you know, pubs sometimes only last three generations in a family. It's been in your family a while. But would any of this deterioration in the behaviour around the pub and the targeting of the pub make you think twice about staying in the business?
There are multiple pubs in the town that didn't reopen after COVID. There are pubs that are up for sale in the town where, let's say, for example, the publican has hale and hearty sons that'd be well able for it. But who would want to wish this on their sons? 99% of the time, this is the greatest job in the world. It's kind of like a farm where you're up all day and all night. There's always something to be done. But
right. You're not comparing the customers to animals now, are you?
No, it's kind of more like they're almost your flock and you're a pastor in some sense. Like, but
right. You're not fleecing them, though, are you?
It's all detracted from.
This is a very dangerous metaphor for a Republican to get into. You're not fleecing your customers, are you?
No.
Or milking them.
Oh, no, that's...
Or leading them to the slaughter.
These analogies are terrible.
Yeah. Well, anyway, look, you love the business. You love being a publican and the interaction with the customers.
Exactly. And the fact that they're coming and telling me about the things that are happening outside, it puts me in a sort of position where I feel like I have to say outwards then that it's unacceptable and that something should be done, you know?
Right. And presumably, I mean, you want the best for the town and the, you know, other businesses in the town. You're a businessman there. You love the town you're working in and you're kind of raising these issues long term for the good of the town, regardless of how people might hear this as a reflection on Nav and the concerns you're raising.
Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, I feel like I've been too personal about this. It's more about the town itself having a bad image following recent events. I mean, we're planning to do a Pride event at the end of June. And from the outset, we were thinking about celebrating all of the, like, Navan has so much artistry and music and
comedy, well known for its comedy as well.
Exactly. And we were a bustling market town, like, and it's such a pity to be tarred with a small group of people who just feel that they're above the law and they can't be cracked down on.
All right. Well, look, best of luck with the Pride event and best of luck with all your endeavours behind the bar and good luck to the customers. I hope they keep safe from here on in. We'll be back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungain here, 51551 for your texts, 087 184 3709 for your WhatsApps, or you can email us at joe@rte.ie. Caelan, good afternoon to you.
Hello, how's it going?
Good, how's Seamon?
He's good now. Like I said, we were just coming back on the way back from the hospital after the operation.
All right, and how did it go, did the doctors say?
It was successful. They managed to sort of reattach the skin, but his finger is still going to be, he's going to have a shorter finger.
All right. Will you tell the listeners what happened to the poor child?
So it was what happened on Monday. He was in school and his finger got caught in between a door. It was either opening or closing. We're still not sure what happened yet. And it basically chopped off the top of his finger. And so we rushed him up to Cork University Hospital, and Now, the thing is, we went into the car park in the hospital. It was full, and I'd seen an Aldi car park, and I well, I'm from Kinmare, you know, and so in the Aldi in Kinmare, if you park there, you know, there's no sort of time limit or anything like that. It's just a free car park, and so I just said here, well, I'll park in the Aldi car park so we can get him into the A&E as soon as possible. So the last thing on my mind was, you know, thinking about the time limit and how long the car was going to be there or whatever. I just was thinking about Shimon, you know.
Right, and because just go back, you know, you got a phone call from Shimon's school telling you about this incident. You rushed to the school. I mean, what did you find there when you arrived?
What actually happened is we got the phone call, and one of the SNAs, Shimon, he's in a special class there. He has autism. So one of the SNAs and another teacher, they drove him from the school to our house. When they arrived up at the door, they handed us Shimon and also a plastic jar with the bit of skin that had been severed.
Right, and was there much taken off the finger? What size of a chunk had been taken out of it?
About half his nail is gone. It's about a little over a half a centimetre, maybe.
Right, he must have been in awful pain, was he? Because I think anyone knows, even getting their hand briefly caught in a drawer or a door. So it had severed his fingernail. Effectively, the top of his finger was gone, was it?
Yeah, gone. Like, it was, yeah. That bit of the finger was sitting in the jar. And that's the piece of skin that was reattached today.
So you get this, the container, and your stepson into the car. But you know, your first thought, as you say, is to get to the hospital quickly, because you were concerned that the longer you waited, the harder the operation would be.
Exactly, exactly. I just wanted to get him seen to as soon as possible. So I just figured, you know, I tried parking in the hospital car park. There was that one car park was full, and I just drove out and quickly parked up in Aldi, and we just rushed into the hospital. And I wasn't thinking about the car really, or where I was parking. And like I said, I went into Aldi because, like I said, I'm from Kinmare, and I just...
They don't really have a time limit on car parking there.
They don't have a time limit, you know, no one's going to...
And was it just yourself and Shimon in the car when you were, like, you piled him into the car and you had the severed piece of the finger with you and you're driving to the hospital? Was it just yourself and himself?
No, it was myself, my partner, and and her daughter, my stepdaughter. So it was the four of us.
You must have been frantic looking for a car parking place, were you?
We were, and it was a hot day, and you know, you're stressed and sweating and tired and. Frantically driving around trying to find a space, so I just went into Aldi.
Right, so you leave the hospital grounds and park in Aldi, and at that stage, you get out of the car and just run, is it?
Pretty much, yeah.
Straight into the hospital. Were you long being seen?
It took about 3 or 4 hours to be seen, and then it took another two hours for him to actually... for them to actually see him and make an appointment with a plastic surgeon and everything like that.
And where were you keeping the finger at this stage? I mean, the piece of the finger, was that put in the fridge, or was it? Did you still have it in the container?
Well, what had happened is my partner had gone in with Shimon because only one parent could go in, so I had to wait outside with their stepdaughter. And the finger, I don't know, it was probably kept, I don't know, I think my partner, she was holding on to it the whole time.
Right. And how soon did the doctors tell you that, you know, you had an appointment and there'd be an attempt made to reattach the missing piece to the finger?
It was about maybe 4 or 5 when my partner, Asha, when she eventually came out, and she told me that they were going to make an appointment for it. And then we had to wait around for another hour or so just to confirm the appointment and she had to sign something for the operation.
And how was Shimon all of this time? He was in shock, was he?
He was definitely in shock. I don't know, really, it's hard to tell with him because, like I said, with the autism, it's sometimes difficult to tell how he's feeling and what's on his mind. But
right, which is a worry for all of you when you're trying to imagine how he's feeling after this shocking incident. Yeah. So you're in the hospital all told about, what, 4 or 5 hours at this stage?
It was 6 hours. Well, me and my stepdaughter, we had nothing to do but wander around the shopping centre that was across from the hospital, and then go back to the hospital and wait outside. We were just waiting around really outside. We couldn't go in.
So anyway, Shaman and your partner are released. You've signed your appointment. You've signed all the paperwork, yeah. And it's time to go home. What happens then?
So we left the hospital and we proceeded towards the car. And when I got to the car, I'd seen that it had been clamped. And I then noticed that there was that car park. You can't park there for longer than an hour and a half. Are you risk being clamped?
And just an ordinary car parking place. You weren't parked in a disabled space or anything else. It was just
No. It was just a regular car. Yeah, just a regular space. Yeah.
Right. And you were clamped. So was there a number there to ring for if you'd been clamped?
Yeah. So there was a number on the window to ring, and so obviously I tried to ring the number because I wanted to try and explain. You know, I fully understand why I was clamped. You know, I understand that there were rules in place and all that, but I called up to try and maybe explain the reason why I'd parked there for so long, that it wasn't just me being negligent or just me taking the, you know. But when I called the number, I got through to this man, and I tried to explain the situation to him, and, you know what I basically said, in a short way, I said my son, who's got autism, he's had the top of his finger chopped off. We had to rush up from Kinmare to the hospital. We were in the hospital for 6 hours waiting for him to be seen. Like, I didn't mean
you would
have
rather
to
have been back within the hour and be seen quickly and go back and collect your car, but it just circumstances didn't allow it. But anyway, they sent out somebody to unclamp the car, did they?
They did.
And did you have to give payment details over the phone in order to get somebody out, or did you pay on the spot?
No, I had to do it over the phone. And you see, at this stage, you know, Shimon was like kind of crying and upset, and because they did have to clean the wound, and because the bone was exposed, it's quite a severe injury. And you know, like, none of us were in very good form, and we just wanted to head home. And I had to call up the number and pay €120 to get somebody out to take the clamp off.
And the fellow who came out to take off the clamp, he, you know, presumably saw the predicament you were in. I mean, he wasn't at that stage in a position to do anything about the €120. He had already paid it, but was there any more sympathy from that direction?
Nope. No, nothing.
Right. And did you try going into the supermarket and talking, or was the supermarket closed at this stage?
They weren't closed, but I wasn't really sure what to do, because it was Munster Car Parking. It was that's the company or whatever it is.
Right.
And I don't know if it's really got anything to do with the supermarket itself.
Yeah, and that'd be common enough. Train stations, car and supermarkets and the like just have a third party provider doing it.
Yeah, that's what they were. It's Munster Car Park Services Limited. That's the one.
Right.
But, yeah.
So Caelan, is it?
Caelan. That's pretty much it.
Well, what
happened?
I mean, do you think there's room for maybe just a bit more flexibility and a bit more case by case basis when people find themselves at the receiving end of a clamp, that maybe people's personal circumstances should be listened to?
Well, I think, you know, common, you know, human, you know, common decency, like human. Had a bit of humanity. The circumstances were, you know, they. It was a very stressful day. You know, I wasn't thinking about the car sitting in the car park. I was just thinking about getting my stepson into A&E so he could get his finger seen to. You know, the whole thing was very stressful for Shimon. You know, it's him I was thinking about. You know.
And how is he now?
He's okay now. He seems to be fine now, but we have to go back on the 27th to have the wound, I think, be cleaned out again and checked. He seems to be fine.
All right. Well, look, we'd wish him all the best, and indeed to you
Thank
as
you.
Well. Wish him. I hope it recovers as well as possible. I appreciate you told me the doctor said that maybe the finger might be slightly shorter than it was before the accident, but I hope he makes as full a recovery as possible, the poor fella. We'll be back after this. We're looking at why other parts of the country outside of Dublin don't really go hell for leather at celebrating Bloomsday.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungine here. Stately, plump Buck Mulligan, Tony Weldon. He can keep his Dublin.
That's me, Colm, yeah.
What do you think of why is Bloomsday limited to Dublin? You have a problem with that, is it?
No, I don't have a problem with that at all. It's just that it all happened by accident. During the COVID, a lot of our neighbours were confined to barracks and bored stiff. So I've always gone to Bloomsday in Dublin, always dressed up and wore the gear and had a bit of fun. I also got a small part in a film called Shem the Pen Man. It was made by two gentlemen down in Cork, Ross and Patrick, and they got the help of the film board. It's on YouTube. Now it's a real joy seeing stuff. It deals with Lucy and her problems, but that's how it started. I invited all the neighbours in, asked them to dress up, asked them to participate on the day. We had wine flowed. Marie cooked the breakfast. And everyone
the full
enjoyed
breakfast,
it.
The lot, kidneys, gorgonzola,
no,
the lot.
You can stuff them now.
Right.
No kidneys. Right. Everything else, but no kidneys. We had the blue cheese, etc. We continued that the year after. It got bigger. And then last year we had it up in Laytown, in the Cottage Inn in Laytown. A beautiful venue. We needed more space. More people came. We had 40... dressed up for Ulysses last year, loads of participation, and it went on for 3 or 4 hours. So that's the crack.
Right. And did you have many takers, many new takers, or were you diverting people away who normally head up to Dublin on Bloomsday?
Look at Colm. I love your name. That's a lovely ring to it, Colm O'Mungine. There's a lovely ring to that. But look at, you take Dublin today. Tomorrow now, Bloomsday, everywhere is going to be booked out. It's online, pay online. And the only stuff you get for free is Davy Burns or up to the square, you know, in Temple Bar. That's all you get for nothing. And to go to all the events, you'd be knackered. Now I'm well in my pension age, and I don't have the energy for all that running around. So that's what we're building a joyous day down here, and we're hoping that it will grow. We have all the press will come. The papers love it. Now I'm the MC. So basically, the way it works, Colm, is this. Now last year and the year before, I spoke only about Joyce from the day he was born until the day he died. Now, tomorrow, I'm going to start off talking about John Joyce and his mother, Mary.
A lot of people know nothing
about those people. If you want to hear a little bit, I'll let you know. Now, John was born in Cork. He was born into a family of elderly parents. They were very wealthy. John was spoiled rotten. He went to UCD, studied medicine, stuck it for a year. Mary Murphy was an importer. Her father was an importer of fine goods. And that's how John met her. And they married. Now, you have to look at it like this.
Right, so no shortage of money in the respective families.
Not at all. No, John Joyce's family were very wealthy. They imported fine food from the continent. And they had a portfolio of the 10 or 12 premises rented out.
But he hadn't a bob to his name then. When he was, by the time he was James Joyce's father, he was moving all over the town.
Like this. John got used to the high life when he was up in UCD. When he was up there, he had the best of apartment. His pockets were full of cash and he loved the crack. He was a great singer. He was a great man with words and he could charm anybody. And you can see, this is where James got all his attributes from. Now, when he headed off up to Dublin with Mary to live in Brighton, in Ratgar, now he went up to a good job. He went up to a job with a corporation. He was rent collector, rate collector, and so on. And life was very, very good. They lived in Ratgar for 4 years, and then they moved over to Bray. Now, he was supposed to have said the reason he moved to Bray was to keep Mary's family from visiting, because they came from Longford, and they would have to come from Longford to Dublin and then out to Bray. Now, we don't know, but there's an awful lot of stuff written about Joyce.
So we've clocked up. So Cork is one place they could celebrate it, because that's where John starts the journey.
Longford,
okay.
Nora, Galway.
What about, you had... Where else have we got? Well, you're making your own mark on the map now. In County Meath, Bray is another one.
Bray could do it, yeah. Look at, they could do it down in Gogarty's place, St. John Gogarty's Hotel, they could do it there.
Right. Kildare, Clongowes Wood College.
Well, they could do it in Clongowes Wood, yeah, they could, of course, yeah. They could do it in Belvedere. You know, there's loads of places that... Look, we can make the Joyce Day bigger than Dublin.
Well, there are connections with Paris and Zurich and Trieste as well, where he's still remembered.
Ah, yeah, no, there is a lot of stuff goes on there. Like, I have friends living in Spain, and they do a Joyce Day, and I have friends living in Italy. They do a Joyce Day.
And do you think it's overdone to the exclusion of other others? I mean, you mentioned that, like, the Bloomsday has been on the go since 1954. Patrick Kavanagh, Flann O'Brien, Brian O'Nolan, Flann O'Brien, Miles Nicopoline, whatever you want to call him, started it off out in Sandy Cove in 1954 and got thoroughly drunk and fell around the towns, fell around the pubs in the city centre. There's other authors that maybe don't have as big a deal made of them as James Joyce. There's a bit of an industry behind them. Is it overdone?
Well, you see, Colin, I don't do Bloomsday, because if I was to start doing Ulysses, the people coming to it would be bored to death. Now, it's all very well, you're up in Dublin, you have the guys from North Arrow Street, and they know their stuff, and they can quote dates, and they can talk about kidneys, and like you have Norris, the way he does his business and does it very well. Now, we don't do that. Now, we will have educated people coming tomorrow, and there will be Joycean people coming tomorrow, and if they want to say their piece, they're very welcome. But we keep it as light as we can. We have loads of people coming that will play music, they'll sing a song, they'll recite
a poem yourself?
From the Joyce collection.
And will you sing yourself?
Oh, I can. Oh, yes, I sing. I've done up a song. I'll give you a verse of it now, and it's about it goes a bit like this. Okay, here we go. Gilness pub is heaven, with coffee at 11, then a stroll down Lake Town Strand. There's no need to hurry, there's no need to worry, you're a king, your lady is a queen. Lake Town Strand's a wonderland, there's music in the air. Sean Nulty plucks his mandolin while the wind reshapes his hair. So if you don't believe me, come and meet me there in Gilness pub on a summer Sunday morning. That's it.
There you go. Very good. And who's the person whose hair is readjusted being mentioned?
Oh,
in the
Sean
song?
Nulty.
Yeah,
Fox
tell
Mulligan.
Us about him.
Yeah, he'll be doing a poem and he plays the flute, and he'll be playing a lot of music that would have been popular at the time.
Stuff
the
like
Spinning Wheel, famous song by Delia Murphy. Then there's a great Delia Murphy connection with Joyce.
What's the connection there?
Oh, huge, yeah. Well, Delia was married to an ambassador, and when she was an ambassador to France, she was she did concerts down in Paris. And James and Nora, they had free passes to all the theatre and the cinema. And they went to see Delia. And Delia, of course, knew who James was. Now, you see, the thing is, Colin, you may not know this, but James Joyce competed in the Fesh, the one that John McCormick was in, and he would have got the gold medal, but for one reason only.
And what was
that
reason?
They loved the song, but they asked him to sight read the music. And he was a man of very high principle. And I'll explain to you afterwards. He refused to read the music, and he was given the second medal. Now, the medal is with your man down in Cork has it, the dancer. Now,
and was he able to read it? He had famously bad eyesight.
Well, the way it was, the fesh wasn't for everybody, because in his day, to ask an ordinary Joe Soap off the street to read music when they could hardly read English. So that was one of his reasons. He refused to read the dots. And when he was in UCD, he also tried to get equal rights for women. So he was a man of very high principle. But going back to Dealey Murphy, Dealey was doing a concert, and she invited James up, and they did three or four songs, and I know it went down very well, because there is some mention of it in some of the books, and she was there for the week, and James and Nora came along.
I suppose people will be familiar enough with the tune "The Spinning Wheel," about the blind lady on the spinning wheel and the couple courting in the background,
and the blind lady on the spinning wheel pretending
she doesn't know what's going on. Jess Olin, you're also celebrating Bloom's Day, not too far away, in Kells as well.
In Kells, that's it. We're only about 45 minutes now from Dublin. Well, we're celebrating it again here in Kells. We've been celebrating for years. Of course, we had the break for COVID. And we'll be in the Bookmarket Cafe. It's Kells Art Club that are organising it. And it's in my little cafe, so that's why I'm on the radio at the moment.
All right, Kells, famous for another famous and more ancient book entirely, although it hasn't landed back in Kells, despite the hopes of the people in the town as yet. So you're celebrating Ulysses tomorrow. Are you going the whole thing cooking? The cooking's not awful, but you are cooking awful.
We are definitely cooking awful, and we'll have the wonderful breakfast, and we'll have the liver and kidneys, and people will come. They'll be dressed in their hats, and they will have their lovely costumes on. We will have readings and songs, and it'll be a great, great morning. And it starts at 11, but it'll go on until 2 or 3.
Right.
It's a great day.
And do you dress up yourself?
Well, yes. I'll probably put on a flouncy skirt or something.
I don't know. Talk us through it. You must have a skirt in mind. What's hanging up in the wardrobe waiting for tomorrow?
What is hanging up in the wardrobe at the moment? Well, I have a long velvet black coat and a lovely underskirt kind of thing. And there'll be some sort of a bodice to go with that.
You're a martyr. That's with the heat there that's out at the moment.
I know, when the cafe is not on the sunny side of the street, it's good. You know, we're on the good side of the street. It's cool. It's cool. In more ways than one, we're cool.
And would you have many takers for offer? Because, you know, people, there's been many discussions had about, you know, how to economise at a time of inflation and eating different cuts of meat. Would you have many takers for liver or indeed kidneys, as stipulated in Ulysses, smelling vaguely of urine?
I know. And they love it. I'm telling you. We might have up to 30 people will come tomorrow, up to 30 people. And out of that, there might be 5 that will say, oh, no, I don't want the liver or the kidneys. But the rest of them will say, yes, and I'll have more when that's all gone.
And how do you cook them?
We will put them in seasoned flour. We will flash them on the pan, and then we'll pop them into the oven then.
All right. And what do you season the flour with? Just salt and pepper, is it?
That's it. That's exactly right. Just keep it simple.
And sear them on the pan and then cook them in the oven at what temperature?
So it only takes a couple of minutes. It only takes a couple of minutes. We'll just put them in the oven. It'll be on at 200. But again, that could only take maybe 10 minutes, just while we're plating up everything else.
And what do you fry them in? A bit of butter, is it?
No. We use Newgrange rapeseed oil. That's what we use in the cafe.
From Newgrange rapeseed oil, James Joyce was reared.
Well, I'm telling you, but he wasn't from the Boyne.
Right. And is there any kind of, do they produce their own natural juices, or do you serve them with a gravy or fried onions or
No. Nothing. We don't. We serve them with mushrooms because it's breakfast. We don't do any fried onions or anything like that. We keep it as a traditional breakfast served with liver and kidney.
Right. But other options on the menu as well for anyone
we usually have a couple of vegetarians, and normally we would have something like a portobello mushroom with Boyne Valley Farmhouse cheese. You know, we'd have something like that in that and serve that as well for anybody that's not eating.
The portobello mushroom doesn't have to smell vaguely of urine, does it?
Well, I hope it won't. No, it won't. Not at all.
No, not like the kidneys. Well, Tony Weldon, there's another venue in Meath that you could possibly visit on your wanderings around celebrating.
Well, if you give that lady my number, I'd love to have a chat with her. and share.
Absolutely. And why not? Why not? Because we're always looking for someone who knows even more than people in the arts club. You know, we'll have people in the arts club that will come and they will have their own story and their own song about Joyce.
To let you know that I have been looking into Joyce for the last 4 years, and I've got a lot of very good information. I have got a couple of sources in Dublin, and I trust what I'm told. So, but as I say to Colm, I stay away from Ulysses because it's way above my... I'm not a scholar. I couldn't deal with that type of stuff. But I found a song that he sang at the Festival, and it was called Love's Old Sweet Song. And before we finish, Colm, I'll just do the chorus for you, if you like.
All right. Well,
I'm just saying to anybody listening, anyone who's coming tomorrow, make sure you wear loads of Factor 50 and a good wide hat and make a contribution. I don't mean that. Come along, enjoy the crack, give us a bit of a song or a poem, and you'll be more than welcome. It's a wonderful day.
And you won't
great
be,
memories
and you,
are made.
And you won't
great
be called on to sight-read music.
Well, we...
Take us into the ad break
music,
with the
no.
verse, Tony.
Yeah, no bother. It's a song called Love's Old Sweet Song. I think this is the one he sung. Now, this is just the chorus.
Give us the chorus.
Just a song at twilight when the lights are low and the flickering shadows softly comes and go. Though the hearts are weary, sad the day and long, still to us at twilight comes love's old song, comes love's old sweet song.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungain here. 47 rifles, 2 security men and 3 herds of elephants. Declan Kelly, where do you fit into this?
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Take us back to 2001 in Zambia and... We were talking about bull attacks earlier in the week. You can go one up on that. An elephant charge.
Slightly. So, yeah, I was there with a group called Green Force, and I kind of wanted my whole life. I was grew up on a farm, so I wanted to... I loved nature and animals anyway. And I wanted to do my part, you know, and kind of save the world kind of thing. So I went out to a place called Kafui Park. It's huge. It's the size of it's massive, and so they wanted a kind of ground-based survey done, like of the flora, fauna, and whatnot. So I went out there, and it was coming to the end of the term. We were there for 3 months, and they said we want to go out there now, elephants this time, and the elephants there can be a bit touchy, because back then anyway. Rules on how to hunt them were quite lax, to say the least.
And was there poaching problems there? Or?
Oh yeah, but there's poaching, yeah, but there, you know, you could hunt them by law, and so there was no real rules to it. Like you can go into any herd, shoot whatever elephant you want. Now that's that. I don't know if things have changed, but that's the way it was then. So they were quite touchy. So we were asked at night, okay, we don't want to force you to do it, lads. Who wants to do it? And I, being me, put my hand up and we had to wait for a little while. So anyway,
what was the specific mission you were being tasked with?
We were to basically survey the animals. And if you want to protect animals in a park the size of it, you need to kind of know where they are in whatever month. Off the year, but animals tend to follow the same kind of routes.
Right. This park, bearing in mind, is bigger than Leinster. It's 22,500 square kilometres, and Leinster is 20,000 square kilometres.
Exactly. It's a bit big. It's like the Phoenix Park wouldn't quite match up.
No, far from it. So you're talking
far about from it. Yeah.
So how did you get around? Were you in?
We walked every day. We were walking each day. You're talking about 40 degrees heat. It was humid. It was like 90%, I'd say. And so very, very hot, very, very warm. So we were put through it each day. So we went out the next day, and we were walking for a while. And I was like, it was a very hot day. And
how many of you are there in the group?
So there was my leader and Andrew. There was myself, and there was two others. There was Rachel and Simon was there as well. And we had two guards with us. So there was it was the six of us, was it? Yeah.
Right. And the two guards are correct. I said 47 rifles. That they were armed with AK-47 rifles.
AK-47 rifles. Yeah, maybe if we had the full amount, things might have been gone the other way. But anyway, so we're walking along, and we're surrounded by trees, and you know we're looking for tracks. We find tracks, and we're going along, and suddenly we hear elephants on our left, and we go, oh great, we found them. And so we kind of just veer left a bit. Then we hear elephants on our right, and we're like, wait a minute, how are they on our right as well? And we kind of went, okay, this might get a bit dodgy, so we'll maybe just come back a little. We'll just kind of reverse a bit. And then we heard elephants behind us.
So there's elephants in three directions?
Three directions.
And when you say you heard them, how close were they?
When elephants want to be heard, they at this point in time, the elephants would have smelled us, for sure. Their sense of smell is ridiculous.
So they're all trumpeting, and are they running at this stage?
No. We think we're fine. There's nothing wrong. We're a bit wary because they were actually, you know, they're all around us. But we're walking along, and I'm saying to myself, well, we're fine. Like, you know, we've got trees. We've had to climb trees in the past to get away from animals. Rhino and whatnot. So we're walking along, and then all of a sudden the trees disappear and we're in grassland.
So you're out in the open.
Trees. We're out in the open, and we're like,
and do you see the elephants at this point?
No, we don't. But we're like, we see trees far away, distance wise, and we're like, okay, we need to go there. So we start to walk quite fast.
How fast?
We're walking along. We're walking at a quite fast pace to get as far away from them as we can.
And where are the guards stationed in all of this?
They're right beside us. And then suddenly I look to my left, and my guard turns around, loads his AK, and says, run.
Run.
And I look behind, and I don't know if you've seen Jurassic Park, where Jeff Goldblum is in the back of the Jeep and the T-Rex bursts out of the trees. That's what happened. Basically, the trees disappeared.
They were flattened.
Just flattened. And
how many elephants?
The bones, 50 plus.
50? How far away from you?
Tree herds. They were a good distance behind us, but elephants don't run, they walk. They're so big. They just stride. They can outrun. A very young elephant can outrun a horse, they say. So we just ran. And our guards started to fire the AKs in the air. Elephants didn't care. So we just ran. We ran. And I mean, you hear about mothers when their child is trapped in either car. They can lift the car up.
Pure adrenaline.
I mean, I don't know how fast we ran, but... We ran for a long time, and I kept on looking behind me, and they kept on getting closer and closer and closer. I'm thinking, this is it. I mean, this is it. And we keep on going, and we finally reach the trees, and like, they're right on us. And we reach the trees, and we get behind the trees, like, and but as we get behind the trees, we heard a scream. Looked behind me, and Rachel had fallen. She had tripped over a branch, and the lead elephant was right on her, and the elephant came right down on top of her and tusked the ground, put the tusks right into the ground. And I thought, that's it, she's gone. And then the elephant came up and kind of went to go again. And we could see she was still alive. She was curled up into a ball. And then Andrew, the leader, God bless him, he went straight, I can see him right now, he went straight to her and put his arms up in the air and just screamed at the elephant. The elephant stopped for a minute. For a second.
All right. We're out of time. You're leaving us on a cliffhanger.
If you want to talk to me again, we can.
We sure can. We're leaving us on a cliffhanger. We're out of time. Liam Mullen was on sound. Broadcast coordinator was Shane Galvin. Sean O'Gorman produced. I'm Cullum O'Mungine. Apologies to Catherine Thomas, but you'll forgive us perhaps after that cliffhanger. She's up next.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.